This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Media giants have been growing bigger in the climate of media deregulation. In early June, the Federal Communications Commission passed new rules allowing cross-ownership of newspapers and TV stations. It also expanded the number of TV stations one company can own. Congress is now considering legislation that would effectively overturn the new FCC rules allowing expanded ownership, but if passed, it could face a veto by President Bush. It may be instructive to look at the recent changes in radio, which was deregulated by the 1996 Telecommunications Act that removed many restrictions on radio ownership and changed the landscape of American radio. For example, Clear Channel, which owned about 40 radio stations before the Telecommunications Act, now owns over 1,200. Critics say that as more radio stations have been bought by media conglomerates, such as Clear Channel and Infinity, which is owned by Viacom, there has been a dramatic decrease in programming diversity and localism. A little later, we'll hear from Clear Channel Radio CEO John Hogan. First, we'll talk with Eric Bollert, who has been covering media deregulation and the consolidation of radio for the online magazine Salon. I asked him what impact he thinks the new FCC rules could have on the media environment.
Well, for the cross-ownership, the concern is, the reason it's never been allowed before is there is a concern that fewer and fewer companies own more and more outlets, and that if a single company owns the major newspaper in Denver and owns 8 radio stations and owns 2 TV stations and might also, be in the telephone and internet business, basically, obviously one company has an extraordinary amount of power and influence, and the concern is, yes, right now most businesses are, good corporate citizens and they do things the way they're supposed to when it comes to journalism and news, but there's always the temptation to start bending the rules and start, putting a company's agenda in the news. And it also, while that company buys up more and more, that allows fewer and fewer other people to own radio stations, to own television stations. The main concern on the TV side, if you own more and more, if Fox and Viacom owns more and more local affiliates, local affiliates traditionally made decisions on what to air in their local markets based on that community. Yes, they're going to take almost all the network offerings, but on occasion, the local GM and affiliate would say, no, we don't want that show. It doesn't meet our standards. Or no, we're going to run a local political debate at 8 o'clock, so we're not going to take that sitcom. When the major companies own all the affiliates, no one says no. There's no local decision making on the local level for TV. So basically the concern is fewer and fewer voices, more and more consolidation.
FCC Chairman Michael Powell very much supports this new deregulation. What's his explanation for why he supports it?
His explanation is the rules are old and they're out of date, and that they made some sense when there were 3 network television stations and there was no internet and there was no satellite television. But his argument is today there was all these choices, so it doesn't really, it's not as important to forbid companies from owning more and more media outlets, and that the marketplace, essentially will figure it out, and the marketplace will be the ultimate decision maker, and companies need to have flexibility and efficiency to operate.
Meanwhile, the Senate Commerce Committee is working on legislation that, if it were to pass, would reverse some of this new deregulation. What are they working on?
They're mostly concerned on the issue of how many local TV stations you can own. That has been the hot button issue in Washington. Politicians are very interested in local television news coverage. They're very interested in local, specifically campaign coverage. So they pay a lot of attention to what goes on the local television. And of all the issues that they have focused on, that's the one they're spending the most time on, and the Senate Commerce Committee, Republican-controlled, voted to essentially try to override the FCC's ruling and limit the number of local affiliates one company could own.
Well, because the new FCC ruling has a lot to do with consolidation of the media, let's look at where we are now with consolidation. The media landscape, particularly the radio landscape, has changed a lot since the 1996 Telecommunications Act. What did that act do that has opened the door to such change?
It basically, as you mentioned, in 96, radio was sort of the one that got through the legislation. Initially, these same rules that we're talking about now were part of that Telecom Act. There was a battle between the Congress and the White House. The White House was opposed to these sweeping deregulations. And finally, they allowed, as sort of as negotiations, to allow radio to deregulate. And what we've seen is it's just massive consolidation, almost beyond what anyone ever dreamt at the time. The largest radio station group is Clear Channel, has approximately 1,200 radio stations. On the eve of the Telecom Act, they had approximately 40. So that right there tells you what has happened to radio. Their 1,200 stations is approximately 1,000 more than the nearest competitor. So, I mean, you can't really underestimate how much has changed in the radio business and what consolidation and deregulation did to the radio business. People today who are still in the business would tell you they don't recognize it. It's not the same business.
Can you just give us an overview of the biggest companies and what each of them own?
For radio?
Yeah.
There are really two major radio players. There's Clear Channel, which has 1,200 radio stations. It's in the top probably 300 markets. I mean, they are everywhere, and they're sort of maxed out in terms of how many they can own in most major markets. And then there's Viacom, which has between 200 and 300. They are mostly in the major markets, in the top 20, top 30, top 40 markets. They are number two in revenue. They're pretty close to Clear Channel in terms of revenue, even though they have 900 less stations because they're in the major markets. And really, once you go past Clear Channel and Viacom, there's a major drop-off, and then there are a handful of medium-sized broadcasters who have, you know, 40, 50, 80, 100 stations. But essentially, the radio industry today is run by two companies.
And Viacom owns Infinity.
Right.
So let's talk a little bit about how this consolidation is affecting what we hear. First of all, a lot more syndicated radio shows.
A lot more syndicated radio shows, a lot more what's called voice tracking. If Clear Channel owns 1,200 radio stations, and say 700 of them are music stations, they're certainly not going to employ five disc jockeys at 700 radio stations to play music. So what they decided to do was fire most of the disc jockeys. And through very clever and high-tech advanced technology, they were able to have a single disc jockey, say, doing an afternoon show in Akron, Ohio on an adult contemporary station and feed that same disc jockey's voice to 40 other adult contemporary stations, feeding in local commercials, feeding in local weather. So listeners sort of think it's local. So that's one way it's changed. I mean, the localism is gone. A lot more nationally syndicated programming is gone. And really, I mean, what you hear on the radio is different just because of the enormous leverage that Clear Channel and Infinity and Viacom have.
What do you mean?
Well, I mean, in terms of the music specifically, when Clear Channel had 40 radio stations, they controlled, and we'll say 30 of them are music, they controlled 30 playlists across the country. So if you're a record company or you're an artist, you want to, of course, get on Clear Channel's playlist. And so Clear Channel had a certain amount of leverage in terms of who they could, what songs they could turn into hits and whose careers they could help. So now if Clear Channel has 600-700 music playlists, Clear Channel is in charge of the music business, really. I mean, you can't have a hit without being on Clear Channel stations. You can't have a career without being on Clear Channel stations. So all of a sudden you have a company that is essentially dictating what gets heard on the radio. I mean, they're not playing anything that's wildly different than everyone else. But if you're a record company and you're an artist, you have to go through Clear Channel to have a career and to have hits. That was unheard of 6 or 7 years ago. There was nobody in 1995, before the Telecom Act, that absolutely picked and chose the hits. If Clear Channel's 30 stations in 1995 weren't going to play your songs, you go around them. You go around them in the markets they are. You go to the competition. You go to different regions, and you try to cultivate your hits. Now you start at Clear Channel. If they're not interested, you go to the next song, you go to the next artist, because there's no point in chasing a song that they're not going to play.
We're talking about the deregulation of media and the consolidation of radio. My guest, John Hogan, is the CEO of Clear Channel Radio. It owned about 40 radio stations in 1996 when the telecommunications bill was passed, which deregulated radio ownership. Clear Channel now owns more than 1,200 radio stations. Now, you've said that deregulation has been good for radio. How do you think it's been good for radio?
Prior to deregulation occurring in 1996, it's important to remember that a significant number, some have placed it as high as 60% of the radio stations in the country, were losing money. Many of them were in danger of actually going off the air, going dark. And I think first and foremost what deregulation has done is it has revitalized the radio industry. The radio business today is in significantly better shape than it was in those, what I like to think of as, unfortunately, dark days of radio back before deregulation.
Do you think it's revitalized radio in terms of profits, or do you think it's revitalized radio in terms of programming as well?
Well, I think both of those, and I think it's also, I'll say, rejuvenated radio as well in terms of a medium in people's minds. I think in terms of content and the quality of programming, it's my opinion that radio is much better today and that it is much more diverse today than it was in 1996, again, as a result of deregulation. And the sort of the backup for that is that prior to companies being able to own multiple stations in a market, you would have multiple companies all vying for dominance of the same opportunity. You would have 2-3 companies all trying to be the country station, or 2 or 3 or 4 stations trying to be the adult contemporary radio stations, multiple companies all vying for the same piece of audio real estate. And so I think deregulation has led, contrary to popular opinion, popular but unfortunately misinformed opinion, it has led to greater format diversity.
Well, give me an example of a market where Clear Channel has a lot of stations and you feel that those stations represent this new diversity that you're talking about.
I'll give you an example in Los Angeles, where today we have 8 radio stations there, one of which is a nostalgia station, 570 AM. Prior to deregulation, the likelihood of having a nostalgia station was really pretty limited in that market. We also have a sort of a urban Spanish hip-hop station, K-Hot, and that format would have been highly unlikely prior to deregulation. We have a CHR station. We have an AC station. We have a hot AC station. And we have a soft AC station. If you go back to pre-deregulation, what you would have found was that that market would have had 2 or 3 similar formats, all owned by different owners, all competing for the same hill. What it has allowed us to do is to increase the format diversity. It's also allowed other owners to diversify their formats as well. And I think the end result is that the Los Angeles listener has much more choice today than they did pre-1996.
But isn't competition supposed to be a good thing?
Competition is supposed to be a good thing. I don't see the connection between having greater format diversity and less competition. Keep in mind that there are virtually no radio listeners, with the possible exception of a few NPR listeners, but there are no listeners who only listen to a single radio station. One of the beauties of radio is that people have multiple choices. And so there is ongoing and built-in competition. Listeners have probably more than most mediums that I can think of have, or most media that I can think of have choices.
Let's go over some of the concerns that have been raised about the number of stations owned by Clear Channel. It's over 1,200 stations.
About 1,229.
Thank you. One of the most common concerns that you hear expressed is that this limits diversity and limits regional identity. Now, you've already addressed the diversity question. Many of the stations owned by Clear Channel use programs that are voice-tracked. They're pre-recorded by a disc jockey who is in another city or state, and those voice tracks can be customized a bit for the local station, but they're still kind of, you know, being recorded someplace else by somebody who's not really in the region. Listeners don't necessarily know that. Good thing, bad thing?
Well, I'm going to back up. Before I answer that, I want to talk about the consolidation part of it first. We do own 1,229 radio stations. That represents somewhere around 11% of the 12 to 13,000 commercial radio stations in the country. I don't see any way possible to conclude that that this is a consolidated industry or that Clear Channel has any sort of real dominance inside that industry. It is a common misperception that we own a far greater percentage of the radio stations that are out there than we actually do. Somewhere less than 12% of the radio stations in the country are owned by Clear Channel. What is also important to understand is that in 1996, every single company in the country, every single individual in the company had the same opportunity to grow their businesses as did Clear Channel. And I actually believe that it's a great American success story. I look at what we have done as an example of good old-fashioned American initiative and success.
Let's get to the issue of voice tracking.
Yes.
Do you share the concern that this is kind of, you know, like homogenizing programming, and also that, you know, regional identity is being taken away, and that people often don't even realize that the host who sounds like maybe they're local isn't even in the same city or state?
I absolutely disagree with all of that, and I want to back up and correct a comment that you made. It is not many of our markets. In fact, less than 10% of our shifts of the day parts on our radio stations. In fact, it's 9% have imported day parts. We do employ the available technology to record some of our shifts. The vast majority of that is done by local announcers and DJs in their markets. I will admit readily that it is extraordinarily different than the way radio was done even when I started some 20 years ago. But I would also say that anybody with an open mind would have to agree that it really results in different but certainly better radio. It allows us to put much better talent in more places than ever before. It allows us to, I think, provide much better content for listeners, certainly better packaging for listeners than they have ever had. There has always been a concern that as radio changed, and it's been one of radio's greatest strengths, is it's been able to reinvent itself and to morph over time. There's always been a concern that somehow it's not been as local or not been as good as it was in the past. And I really dispute that. Radio is an inherently local medium, and as a radio company and personally as a radio broadcaster, I get the absolute importance of connecting on a local level with our listeners. It's why we employ over 900 program directors who are all based in markets, local markets, their home markets all across the country. It's why we have such an incredible emphasis on providing local news, weather, traffic, sports information, school closings, blood drives, all of the things that people want to know about their local communities.
Let me ask you about playlists. Since Clear Channel owns more than 1,200 stations, there's a lot of concern that Clear Channel could, you know, control what's heard and what's not, who gets a hit, who doesn't, who gets airplay, who doesn't. How are playlists created for the Clear Channel music stations?
Clear Channel playlists are created in essentially the same way in every market, and that is by the local markets. We have, as I said earlier, we have a tremendous belief in the power of local radio, which is why we employ 900 program directors and literally thousands more of programming staffers, music directors, assistant PDs, and so on, to help gather the research that we do in local markets. We make literally millions of calls in markets all across the country to find out what our listeners hear. And the short, simple answer is that our playlists are determined by local program directors.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We're talking about media deregulation. The FCC passed new rules last month allowing cross-ownership of newspapers and TV stations. It also expanded the number of TV stations one company can own. Congress is considering legislation that would effectively overturn some of the new FCC rules. We're looking at how radio has changed since it was deregulated in 1996. A little later, we'll hear again from John Hogan, the CEO of Clear Channel Radio, which owned about 40 stations before the 1996 deregulation and now owns more than 1,200 radio stations. First, we hear again from Eric Bollert, who has been covering media deregulation and the consolidation of radio for the online magazine Salon. Clear Channel not only owns many radio stations, it now owns concert promotion and production companies. I asked Bollert if he thinks this has changed things for recording artists and record labels.
Clear Channel essentially owns the concert business in America. It owns the venues, it owns the promotions, it owns the tours. Before that happened, if you're an artist, you have two ways to make money. You can make money touring, and you can make money selling records. Today, most artists don't make money selling records for a variety of reasons. So they're going to make their money touring. And how do you sell tickets? You sell tickets by being on the radio. So that you're an artist, and there you go in terms of, you know, the two gates you have to pass through to have a career in the American music business, and they're both owned by Clear Channel. And a few years ago, when it was all sort of coming together, when Clear Channel had just bought the concert industry, there were concerns that, well, what's going on here? I mean, if I have to pick a concert promoter and I'm going to go out on the summer tour and I can pick a Clear Channel promoter or I can pick a competitor, what does that mean to my chances of being on Clear Channel radio stations? And how am I going to sell concert tickets if my songs aren't being played on Clear Channel stations, or maybe they're not going to run my ads for my local concert? So artists and labels and managers, you know, saw the obvious and said, let's just tour with Clear Channel and not take any chances. I mean, the music business is hard enough. I mean, it is really, it's extraordinarily difficult to have a hit, to have a career in the music business today. So the feeling is, why take any chances? We better, you know, let's tour with Clear Channel and we'll have a better chance of getting on Clear Channel radio stations again. Before deregulation, that was unheard of. I mean, radio and the concert business, in terms of ownership, had nothing to do with one another. That's completely changed now.
Singer Don Henley testified at a hearing that his manager had represented an artist whose song was boycotted on Clear Channel stations after the artist refused to perform free at a promotional concert. Do you hear this type of thing a lot, that you have to play ball?
Oh, yeah. You have to play ball, and Clear Channel's gotten better about it now, but a couple years ago when they were sort of, they had this mentality, if you talk to people in the music business, that, wow, you know, we've got 1,200 radio stations, we own the touring business, this is great, we can do whatever we want, no one is going to mess with us, no one is going to tell us how to run things, and in fact, we're going to play hardball. And if people don't want to, do business with us, we're going to tell them what's going on. We're going to send memos to the record company saying, you know, this band, we're having trouble with this band. It's not touring with us. We're going to take them off the air in a couple different markets. You mentioned, you know, Don Henley and that song getting boycotted. The problem is that all of these radio stations, not just Clear Channel, but they put on these promotional concerts. They put on a big summer concert. They put on a Christmas concert for free. Well, it's free for the artists. They don't get paid. But it's a way for these stations to make money. And so they ask all these artists to come in and perform for free. And it's, you know, it's sort of a conflict, because if you're, say, Don Henley, and you're being asked to perform at a Clear Channel free radio concert, well, you know, I was going to come into that market a month from now. Now I won't be able to sell tickets because I have to do these free radio concerts. And what he was talking about was an artist that said, no, I'm not going to do the free concert. She was actually trying to finish up recording an album. I'm not going to do your free concert. I have to finish my album. And the allegation was she didn't perform at the free Clear Channel concert. So when the record came out, her song was not played on the radio stations. So there's all sorts of these really messy sort of hardball tactics that people allege have been going on, and everyone is, you know, trying to figure out how you go about this. How do you try to get on the radio station? How do you tour? How do you perform the endless string of free concerts for radio stations and still try to have a career? And can you do it without going through Clear Channel?
If you're just joining us, my guest is Eric Bollert. He's a senior writer for Salon, the online magazine, and he has been following media consolidation and changes in the radio industry and the music industry for the past couple of years. There was an antitrust suit that was filed against Clear Channel in 2001. What was that suit about, and what's the status of it now?
The status of it is it continues to sort of, I believe, plod along in the court system. Depositions are being taken, I believe, and it will, it's moving slowly. What it was about was, in Denver, Colorado, Clear Channel has a very a prominent concert business, and it's, of course, as in any major market, lots of radio stations. There was a small independent concert promoter, Nobody in Particular, is the name of the company, and they alleged that Clear Channel, when an act would come into a market, that an act that Nobody in Particular had worked with in the past, when it was playing bars, when it was playing small clubs, each year it would come back, the band would get a little bigger. The allegation was Clear Channel was going to artists and essentially telling them that, you know, if you want to be on Clear Channel radio stations, you need, when you come to Denver, you need to do business with Clear Channel concerts. And if you want your ads, your commercials to sell those tickets, you need to be with Clear Channel, or Clear Channel radio is not going to run those ads. The allegation was that Nobody in Particular had tried to just go to the Clear Channel stations, buy spots like everyone else to advertise concerts, and that the Clear Channel radio stations either were not running the spots or burying them at 2 o'clock in the morning, and therefore Nobody in Particular could market the concert, because if you're marketing a rock concert, you're going to sell your tickets on rock radio. I mean, that's how most of the fans find out about the show. So the allegation was that they, you know, refused to advertise the show, and that Clear Channel was sort of dangling airplay in front of artists when they come to Denver, with the allegation being, you need to do business with us if you want to be on Clear Channel radio. And of course, Nobody in Particular doesn't own any radio stations in Denver or anywhere else, and they felt they were, you know, at a disadvantage. They could not compete in that kind of marketplace.
So that suit is still in play?
I believe it is, yes.
Now, there are criticisms during the war in Iraq that Clear Channel was holding pro-war rallies, and that artists who spoke out against the war risked not getting played on Clear Channel stations. Now, Clear Channel said that these rallies were actually organized by local stations, not corporate headquarters, and that they were rallies for the troops, not necessarily in favor of the war. Did you investigate that at all?
Well, yeah. I mean, Clear Channel is right in that they were organized by local stations. It was not a top-down sort of edict coming down from the Clear Channel CEO saying we're gonna run pro-war rallies, but it's not that quite simple either, because for one thing, Clear Channel has very close ties with the Republican Party, and specifically with the Bush family. Clear Channel CEO Lowry Mays is a good friend of Bush Sr. He campaigned for Bush Jr. He's donated, he and his family and the company have donated heavily to the Republican Party. The face of Clear Channel Talk Radio is Rush Limbaugh. That's their largest draw. Rush Limbaugh has spoken at Clear Channel managers' conventions, you know, urging them to, you know, vote Republican, as Lowry Mays has done. So there's a clear connection between Clear Channel and the Bush White House and the Republican Party. And these rallies that were taking place, I mean, they were important for a couple reasons. A, you know, at the time, the only people making news in terms of rally was the anti-war protests. So if this was sort of a silent majority they were dealing with, what they did was they sort of provided this turnkey operation. I mean, they scheduled these rallies. They, you know, booked them in their concert halls. They took care of all the permits. They took care of the planning. They brought in entertainment. I think for anyone who's tried to plan a protest, it would be nice if you could just hand it off to a company and please do it. And, of course, they advertised it nonstop on the radio stations. So it really was, it was not a top-down sort of conspiracy, but it also wasn't just, gee, let's put on these rallies and see what happens. I mean, they were very well done, and they provided an extraordinary resource. And as I talk to people in the radio business, I don't think any Clear Channel manager would be foolish enough to host an anti-war rally. I mean, everyone knows what Clear Channel's politics are, and everyone in the company knows where Lowry Mays is coming from politically. So I think that was reflected in the rallies, and I think they provided a real value at a time when the White House was looking to rally public support for the war, which was at the time just, you know, weeks away.
Eric Bollert covers media deregulation and the consolidation of radio for the online magazine Salon.